This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to The Changing Face of Fairview, a series of programmes about how Fairview has changed over time. In this programme, we'll be talking about important connections and associations, historical, cultural and architectural. We'll be talking about the famous Bram Stoker, the 1916 Easter Rising, the James Joyce connection, and the most wonderful architectural wonder called the Casino Marino. So I spoke to Michael Fitzgerald and Dennis McIntyre about the boundaries of Fairview and where they lie.
Okay, well, I suppose a great landmark in Dublin history always was, and indeed still is, and that's the famous Ballybough Bridge. And maybe we'd start there, having a look at, you know, how the identity of today's Fairview came into being. Now, up to and including much of the 18th century, the sea was not confined by embankments, and the Strand extended from Ballybough Bridge to Beresford Place.
Okay. The triangle itself, which I call the eastern boundary, or the western boundary would be the Tolka. And then you had the two bridges, one at Ansley Bridge Road, and the other one, which is now called the Luke Kelly Bridge. We used to call that the Tolka Bridge. And you can easily draw a triangle. If you come down the main road there, you get down to Edge's Corner, and then you do a left, and that takes you back down to Luke Kelly Bridge. Now, what characterised the area, as opposed from the others around it, is it had less of what you would call the visible poverty that was clearly, you only had to go down to Ballybough Bridge or the Luke Kelly Bridge, and you could look over the bridge and you could see the poverty clear as day in the other side.
And as thank you to Michael Fitzgerald and Dennis McIntyre for that introduction to Fairview. Next up, I did a walkabout with Gareth Brennan, local architect in Fairview Strand.
And the park itself is a huge amenity. I lived about 60 yards from the gate of the park and used it as much as I could, and it was one of the shining benefits of living in Fairview.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that Fairview underwent a development explosion from about 1830 until about 1890 or thereabouts.
Yeah. It was a very desirable area. Then the cinema, then the facade of the cinema has been preserved, so that in itself is something positive.
Yeah, the facade of the cinema is really beautiful. There are so many examples of these cinemas throughout Dublin which have been either retained or converted, and the one in Fairview is no exception. It's now, the auditorium is nearly completely gone. Most of the facade, or the building behind the facade, is now a shop, but at least the facade itself has been retained.
I think it's Tesco's at this point in time, isn't it?
It is, yeah, actually, yeah. Tesco's, yeah, it's Tesco's.
So Tesco's is everywhere.
For its entire length, Fairview Strand is generally, has been well preserved. Most of the original buildings are still present and still intact and still used. Then coming along past the cinema, which we've already talked about, we get to Joey's, as you say, which is a complex of buildings at this stage. Originally, the earliest ones dating from probably the late 1800s, and the later additions throughout the 20th century, essentially. The building marks the spot where the original gate into Marino House once stood, which has long since vanished. It's now the site of the pedestrian footbridge, but the school have taken their motto from the motto of the original that stood on the original gate.
Okay, you mentioned Marino House there. Could you just tell our listeners who wouldn't be familiar with the history of Marino House, what was there originally, Marino House, very close to where we're standing?
It was, in the 1700s, obviously, Fairview was complete countryside, and those who had townhouses in Dublin City also had country houses outside, and Marino House was an example of one of these. It was built by Lord Charlemont, who built it in the 1730s, I think, after returning from a grand tour around Europe. He was so taken by the Bay of Naples that he was reminded of Dublin Bay and commissioned the building of the house around that time. And the only remaining element of the house today is the casino at Marino, which was built as a folly in the grounds of the house. Directly across from us is the Marino Technical Institute, which was originally built in 1938, I think, by Robinson Keith Devan. They were synonymous with Irish modernist architecture. It was the modernist movement originated in Europe in the early 1900s, and it took a while to get to Ireland. The most fine example would be the original Dublin Airport building. But this building here is an exceptional example, I think, particularly the way that the facade curves slightly to reflect the park opposite.
Okay, the Casino Marino stands proud above Fairview, and I went on a visit to it to find out more about its past.
Well, the Casino Marino is really a jewel in the crown of what was a large 300-acre domain called the Marino Domain, and it was developed by Lord Charlemont, whose name was James Caulfield and his title was Lord Charlemont, and he really developed the area of Marino.
So he did this grand tour of Europe. He was very excited about it. Bring us very briefly through this tour that he did and how he brought it back to Fairview, to Marino.
Well, James, from a very young age, was fascinated with ancient Greece. And like any young nobleman in the 1700s, he embarked on his grand tour, which was really just the male's form of education. Yeah. They travelled through Europe and their main destination was Italy. Mm. However, James didn't go on the normal two-year grand tour. He was one of the first men to extend his travels into ancient Greece, Constantinople and ancient Egypt. And that's why throughout the building of the casino, you'll see the influence of the Egyptian, the Greek and the Roman. And the purpose of the building is a pleasure house.
Yeah.
Casino comes from the Italian casina, meaning small house of pleasure for entertainment.
Yeah.
And Marino actually means next to the sea or on the water's edge.
So let's have a look at a map. There's a map somewhere of the domain. I think it's just here next door. And this links in Fairview with, shows how Fairview was so important with this domain.
It does indeed. It kind of shows us the origins of Fairview, if you like. Yeah. Here we have the landed estate of Lord Charlemont. And we're standing here now in the little temple building, the Casino Marino. And here's Marino House, as it would have been at the time, which sadly no longer stands. But interestingly enough, the gates to the estate, the main gates, stood roughly at the site where Joey School in Fairview is today. And the Marino name comes from the fact that Fairview Park, as we know today, didn't exist in the 1700s. It's all reclaimed land, and that meant the Sea of Dublin Bay came lapping right across from the gates, hence the name Marino, a little pleasure house on the water's edge. Fairview, in fact, and Marino. Marino was written about in the 18th century because of the view. So what later became Fairview was considered to be one of the most beautiful aspects in Dublin. We have the Dublin Mountains to the right, the Wicklow Mountains to the left, and the Sea of Dublin Bay right in front. And people used to travel from all over the world to have a look at this view from the roof of the Casino Marino.
The famous Irish writer James Joyce lived in several houses in Fairview when he was a student at UCD. And I talked to Stephen Darcy, who lives in one of those houses.
Well, the Joyce family were, I suppose, James Joyce's father was actually, I suppose, landed gentry, originally from Cork. And he was like that, a gentleman, didn't really work, didn't work until later years. And I suppose as his fortunes declined, as he moved up to Dublin, he started to have to move around. The reason his fortunes declined was that he kind of spent more than he made.
Did he pay the rent at all?
Well, this is the thing. This is one of the reasons that he had, 16 different addresses. This is the 13th of the 16 addresses. And basically, James Joyce's father could justify, money for eatables, whereas he could never justify paying the exorbitant prices in rent in Dublin. Yeah. So
when you mentioned that Joyce was the first to bring cinema to Ireland, that would be very historic. So could you just maybe explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I don't know a huge amount about it. I mean, there hasn't been a large amount written. What I do know is that he had set up the Volta cinema on Mary Street.
You mentioned there earlier about the fact that there's this laneway at the back, and when Joyce was at the university living in this house, he used to use this as an escape route. Why was that?
Well, I suppose because of his diminishing resources in money, the father slowly kind of took this out on his nearest, I suppose, loved ones, and that was his family. So he kind of drank a huge amount, and he, with drink, it brought out a bit of a temper. So his temper did decline as the years went on, and the reason we mentioned the lane at the back is because it was mentioned in, what would be the autobiography, which is a portrait of an artist as a young man by James Joyce. And he used this book almost to kind of you know, describe his life from a young man right through up until adulthood. So being an autobiography, the lane is actually mentioned in the book. Yeah. So this is why we kind of come to reason that James himself, obviously on his way to university, you know, in order to kind of get out of the house early in the morning before his kind of his father, you know, woke with a bad hangover. I suppose this is his way of escaping out the back door, so he wouldn't be spotted.
Is it in the Portrait of an Artist he mentions, has references to Fairview and walking along the coast and that kind of thing?
Yes, I suppose after he, you know, I know it has been written that, you know, some of his happiest times, I suppose, were this house, number 8, Inverness. And basically what he did was, with his siblings, he used to go down, like the Bull Wall was quite near, so he used to head down there. And then he used to go, on his way to university, he would travel down onto the Fairview Strand. And there was a tram back then, and a tram actually went all the way into the city centre. So he would either take the tram as far as maybe Talbot Street. He used to kind of alight at Talbot Street and then just kind of soak up the morning atmosphere of Dublin. He would maybe walk down as far as Stephen's Green. And then other times then he would just kind of walk all the way there.
Eileen Kinnan grew up in Fairview in the 1930s. She has fond memories of the area, and she spoke to me about the games she played as a child.
We played Conkers, we played Relivio.
So what was Relivio?
Relivio was, you go from one side to the of the road to the other. And you'd be knocked down. If you were knocked down, you were out. But you'd get over to the other side, you were lucky.
And then when there was snow, then you had a kind of a Trent warfare.
We had a great time. We had really a good time when the snow would fall. One of the roads and our avenue would have a trench built across. With the snow, it was so good, so plentiful. And then we'd have a war, a battle. But I was young, I was very young, and I was always just making the snowballs for to pass them down with the bullets or whatever, you know. It was great fun.
And so that was then, and you also had this game, button, some kind of a button game. How did that work?
We had the button game. We used to sit and we'd hold our hands tightly together, and the person had the button that was standing up while we were sitting down in the circle, and she'd come along or he'd come along and say, hold the button very, very tight. And we'd press on the button, not to let anyone see that we had the button, right? And then and then they go to the priest of the parish has lost his consideration cap. Some say this and some say that.
So what was that about then, the priest?
That was one of the things that was connected with it, you know, the rhymes. That was the rhyme. And it was great, great, great fun. And we had marbles. And we'd play in the trench with the marbles outside the doors. They were spotless.
That's great.
Simply because simply because they had the roads tarred. The men were very good. The corporation men were excellent.
Fairview played a key role in the preparation for the 1916 Easter Rising and in the Rising itself. Standing outside the house where Thomas Clark, one of the leaders of the 1916 Rising, lived, Garth Brennan, local architect, spoke to me about the current condition of this house and of the importance of its preservation for future generations.
The house dates from to the early to mid 1800s, and in its current condition is essentially, it's largely semi-derelict. It is inhabited at the moment, but is in very, very poor repair, and a hugely important building given the historical significance and the, as you say, the imminent 2016, you know, centenary celebrations of the 1916 Rising.
Yeah.
It's a terrible shame that the house is in the condition it's in. I mean, as you say, it was the residence of Tom Clark up to in the run-up to the 1916 Rising. He was the first signatory of the Declaration, or the Proclamation of Independence, and his wife, as you said as well, subsequently lived in the house after his capture and execution. So it's of national importance, this building, and really it is, you know, it would be fantastic if it was acquired and refurbished and brought back to, you know, the glory that it had in its heyday.
Continuing the story of the Easter Rising 1916, I asked Niall Ring, whose family participated in the Rising, to talk about the importance of the Howth gunrunning plot and the involvement of local Fairview residents.
Yes, the Howth gunrunning was obviously a very important event because it essentially armed the volunteers for the forthcoming, or well, it was 2 years later, the Rising.
Yeah.
And it was in July 1914 that Erskine Childers aboard the Asgard managed to get about up to 1,000 Mauser rifles and ammunition. But in any event, it was the connection with Fairview. There is, it was the 2nd Battalion, which was the battalion in the Fairview area and surrounding area, that were requested to go out to Howth and meet the Asgard when it docked, and to bring the guns in through Raheny and into the inner city in around Fairview, yep. Ballybock, North Strand. So when there was confrontation, the plan was to move the rifles backwards through the ranks to the back of the cortege, so to speak, and from there they were taken by bicycle, mainly by Fianna Éireann, who were basically the young kids who were helping, and brought to various safe houses around the area, and in particular into Father Matthew Park, and a lot of them were stored there.
Yeah, so Father Matthew Park then became a training ground for the volunteers, and also you mentioned to me earlier Croydon Park. So Croydon was a big house, was it? It was a kind of an estate.
Croydon Park was an estate, but at that stage it had been fairly derelict. In fact, Tom Clark at one stage lived in Croydon Park House, and he also lived around in Fairview in Richmond Avenue.
Now, Richmond Avenue House is still there. Just
that's right.
Divert
yes.
that just for the moment. Now, would it not be an idea for yourself as an independent councillor to push for Dublin City Council to acquire this house and to have it as a memorial to Thomas Clark and the men of 1916, acquire it, because it's in danger at the moment because it may not be properly maintained at the moment. I just got the impression.
Yes, I understand at the moment it's in various flats, and there's it's a lovely house at the end of Richmond Avenue.
Yeah.
And it would be a very good idea, but I would think in terms of Thomas Clark, who had served many years in jail in England and subsequently went to New York and came back from New York as an IRB member, and was there to his little tobacconist shop in Parnell Street would have been a focal point of getting everybody together. Unfortunately, at the moment with Dublin City Council, we're having issues trying to even preserve the National Monument site at 14 to 17 Moore Street.
So at this point in time, Fairview was the centre of the whole movement towards the Easter Rising, Easter Monday 1916. And tell us about, there were many organisations. There was the Citizens Army, there was the IRB, and there was the Irish Volunteers, there was the Gaelic League, there was the Cumann na mBan. And you mentioned there earlier Fianna Éireann, who are, if you like, a younger group. So tell us about these organisations then and the roles they played, roughly.
Well, the roles they played, I mean, obviously the volunteers were set up, and they were the open, they were allowed train. The British authorities didn't see them as a real threat, but they were allowed train. The IRB would have been the secret military organisation behind the Rising, and many IRB men were obviously in the volunteers, whereas all volunteers weren't in the IRB. And one in Fairview, for example, Frank Henderson, who was the captain of F Company, he would have been a member of the volunteers, but not a member of the IRB. But you then had the Gaelic League was extremely strong at this time because there was a great revival in Irish culture, Irish language, Irish heritage.
Yeah.
And many volunteer, the Gaelic League would have been a grounding for getting, or a ripe ground for getting members into the volunteers.
Yeah.
They would have had in the Fairview area, they had a hall on Clonliffe Road and also had one on Richmond Avenue, and there was one further out in Clontarf.
Yeah.
Cumann na mBan were obviously the women who were interested in the fight for freedom and the struggle, and would have been ancillary and helping in whatever way they could, and in a vital way, as it turned out, in the GPO.
The world-famous vampire book Dracula was written by Bram Stoker, who was born in Fairview. Dennis McIntyre, expert historian, told me Bram's life story.
Bram Stoker was born at number 15 the Crescent, Clontarf. Yeah. Fabulous, half-moon-shaped group of Georgian houses.
Mm.
Now, Bram was born in the year 1847 at the height of the Great Famine in Ireland. It was a terrible time in the country. Mm. It was probably our Holocaust, really.
Yeah.
And I think that had a telling impact on his life's work later on, because he lived with famine stories, he grew up with famine stories and so on.
Mm.
Now, a lot of people don't know, Bram Stoker was in fact an invalid.
Yeah.
He couldn't, in the sense that he couldn't walk until he was 7 years old.
Okay.
We've never found out exactly why. We don't know whether psychological or physical or a bit of both.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that three of the brothers were doctors and one of his uncles treated him, William Stoker, all records seem to have been destroyed. And we think Bram himself was like that. He deliberately destroyed most records to keep us guessing. He was delicate and weak.
Mm.
In the country, we had a word called weedy. If you were weedy, you weren't that strong as other children of your own age.
Yeah.
So he wasn't fit to attend local primary school. Mm. He had to be sent to a private school. This was up to about 10. He didn't walk until he was 8 and 7, 8, and still at 10, 11, he was still very delicate. And Donny, that's another more country word, I think.
Donny,
delicate. The tables began to turn slowly. And when he was 11, 12, or 13, he began to shoot up, grow up tall, and get his strength, as it were.
Yeah.
And talk about a child who couldn't walk until he was 7. By the time he was 14, 15, he had grown into almost 6 foot. Yeah. And at 16, he went to Trinity College. He was, in fact, 6 foot 2.
All right.
Yeah. And he became very, very prominent on the sports field, if you don't mind, for a guy who couldn't walk. He became a great rugby player. He became a weightlifter. He became a swimmer, a cycler, a walker, and won many medals in all these disciplines.
Yeah.
So he's a great role model, in fact, for any child who might feel physically incapable or whatever, inferior at an early stage.
Yeah,
that is, it's never too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he went to Trinity College, of course, and he absolutely loved Trinity.
Mm.
And he became auditor of the Historical Society and president of the Philosophical Society, two of the big societies.
They had the big jobs.
But he loved debating. He just loved it. And he was obviously very, very intelligent.
Yeah.
And very, very meticulous with notes and that type of thing.
Of course, yeah.
Now, when he left Trinity, he went to Dublin Castle as a civil servant. That was the old imperial civil servant service in the castle, where his father had worked, and indeed his grandfather.
Yeah.
But Bram hated the civil service. He wasn't born for an office.
Yeah.
So, he was so bored, he his real interest in life was drama.
Hmm.
And he went to all the theatres in Dublin at the time, like the Queen's in Pier Street, the Theatre Royal, of course, and the Gaiety, which is still there.
Yeah.
And this is what was going to change his life forever. Hmm. He saw a British actor called Henry Irving in action on stage.
Hmm.
Irving was a great Shakespearean actor in the role of, you know, Hamlet and Macbeth and all those.
Yeah.
And the drama scene in Dublin was very, very small.
Hmm.
And this Henry Irving had a group of players called the Lyceum.
Yeah.
And they came to Dublin regularly enough, a few times a year sometimes, put on shows. And Bram was mesmerised when he saw this man acting.
Yeah.
And he started to write columns free of charge for the main Dublin paper, the Dublin Evening Mail, praising Henry Irving in particular, but encouraging people to join the drama circle in Dublin, to come and see it, because people didn't know about drama.
They
felt it wasn't for them. Or
yeah, it wasn't for them.
Maybe above them,
the
even.
Elite, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he encouraged it. And I argue ever since that we're talking about the 1880s here, and around that time, sort of the National Irish Movement, you know, the GAA and the Gaelic League and all these were getting up. Now, Maud Gonne and William Butler Yeats and Millington Synge and those people took up where Bram was leading them.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And eventually opened the Abbey Theatre as the Irish National Theatre in 1904, I think it was the year. Mm, so yeah. I argue that Bram Stoker was the real founder of the National Theatre.
Yeah.
So right. This Henry Irving, anyways, spotted that Bram was loved drama genuinely and was a good businessman as well. He met him a few times. So he asked Bram, anyways, to become his manager and to manage the theatre he owned in London called the Lyceum. Bram was thrilled, of course.
Yeah.
Now, he was engaged to be married at the time. This, we're talking about November 1878.
Yeah,
78. He was engaged to a local girl called Florence Balcombe, who, in fact, had been courted previously by a certain Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyways, he went to Florence, and they both decided to bring forward their wedding. They were going to get married in 1879. So they brought it forward a year. So in 1 week, they got married. Moved to England and set up a new life, and Bram became Irving's manager, secretary, all the rest of it, and he was to remain with Irving for the rest of his Irving's life. In fact, 26 years.
Yeah.
Now he managed the cinema brilliantly.
Yeah.
The Lyceum.
Yeah.
And he brought many new ideas to drama and theatre. Like, for example, he was the first one to invent, you know, pre-booking of seats.
Yes.
It seems simple nowadays, but he was forced to think of it.
Yeah.
And things like that. And he picked the proper shows for Irving. Yeah. And Irving, under his influence, became the first actor to be knighted.
Oh, which, I see.
Because that time acting mightn't have been regarded as, you know, the most safe of professions or whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was a big thing.
Yeah.
And the players, probably the biggest thing he did was, with the Lyceum, he organised 10 tours of America from about 1899 to 1900. Now, touring America didn't mean you went to Heathrow and you flew to Kennedy. There was no Heathrow and there was no Kennedy.
Right. Yeah.
So it meant organising train carriages from London. They brought everything by the stage. They brought props wigs and about 100 actors and makeup artists and the whole gang and via train to Liverpool.
Yeah.
Then they crossed a 3 month or four even crossing to New York.
Mm.
And in a very young America... They crisscrossed America over the 10 tours from New York sort of to California and from Mexico to Canada.
Yeah.
And Bram organised all this. Irving just went along with his cigar and his brandy or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but Bram liked it. He was a PR man and he loved his tail coat and his high hat. And he met a part of it in America. He met Theodore Roosevelt, who was to be president.
Yeah.
He met Walt Whitman, the poet.
Yeah.
And the writing elite in America and all that came to the show. So he was quite happy.
Yeah.
But it took its toll on him. And, eventually Irving died in 1905 and Bram himself got a stroke.
Right.
And he lived on to 1912. And it's easy to remember when Bram died because he went down the same week as the Titanic, which was in April 1912.
Yeah.
And that was Bram's life story, more or less. Yeah. Now, what did he achieve? Well, he achieved a lot. He wrote 17 books in all.
All right.
And his masterpiece, Dracula, was published in 1897. Now, it has records that will never be equaled, never mind surpassed.
Yeah.
For example, it's still the biggest selling novel ever written in any language anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
That's unchallenged.
Oh, yeah.
Only the Bible as a book beats it. And the Bible isn't really a book. It's a book of books, if you like.
It's not a novel, but
Hollywood tell us that they can identify 1,000 major films in some way inspired by that book.
Yeah.
Now, that's a record that's just unreal.
Yeah.
The book has never been out of print, of course.
Yeah.
It has been published in about 60 languages that we know of. In other words, all the major languages of the world and many minor ones.
Yeah.
For example, the first translation from English was, in fact, Icelandic.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know, there's a Gaelic translation. 1933, Sean O'Keefe and the Civil Servant.
Yeah.
Translated Dracula into Irish,
right,
into Gaelic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would have read Dracula in Irish for the first time.
Yeah.
The Dracula. So it has a wonderful, wonderful record.
That is all for this programme, and I wish to say thank you to Dennis McIntyre, Michael Fitzgerald, Garth Brennan, staff of the Casino Marino, Stephen Darcy, Eileen Canan, Niall Ring. And a very special thank you to the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland who have sponsored this series on Near FM, The Changing Face of Fairview.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.